Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the strange climate of fear and suspicion surrounding Chinese scientists working in U.S. institutions and how it might set back America's progress toward curing cancer. We'll spend this hour with journalist Peter Waldman of Bloomberg News, talking about evidence the federal government is surveilling oncology researchers with ties to China because of fears that they'll share intellectual property from U.S. scientific organizations with peers overseas. As we'll hear, international cooperation is encouraged by institutions trying to cure cancer, but scientists who partner with Chinese labs are finding themselves targeted for additional scrutiny and even surveillance. Our conversation starts after a short break. Cancer will be a victory for all of humanity. Scientists now eagerly collaborate with peers around the globe to share insights and experimental data, often at the express direction of their institutions. As the dean of research at Baylor College of Medicine puts it, faculty don't see international borders anymore. But federal agencies do see borders, and scientists with ties to Chinese labs are facing unprecedented scrutiny in a climate of deep suspicions about intellectual property theft. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Peter Waldman is a reporter for Bloomberg News. When he looked into this issue, he discovered a spike in the number of FBI investigations of ethnically Chinese scientists at U.S. cancer labs, many of which fail to produce sufficient evidence to convict or even prosecute those who fall under suspicion in the first place. His recent article is headlined, "The U.S. is Purging Chinese Cancer Researchers from Top Institutions." Peter, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So you discovered that cancer researchers around the world don't recognize international borders when it comes to sharing data and collaborating with colleagues in other countries. What is the upside of those international partnerships? Why are they necessary?
So it's the benefit of globalization across all of our lives. When it works, it's quite wonderful. And in research, it's a matter of finding the missing piece of a puzzle in some far-off laboratory or with some academic researcher in another country. And these researchers tend to meet one another at international conferences. They see their work on posters and presentations. They say, hey, I'm working on something similar. Let's compare data. Let's compare notes. Maybe that will result in an invited lectureship or something like that. And ultimately, they'll produce a paper together if things go well and maybe break some new ground.
And even the U.S. National Cancer Institute's Moonshot program has a motto, which is cancer knows no borders.
That is true. I think it's been universally recognized, globally recognized, if shall we say, that these collaborations work extremely well. I mean, there have been multiple Nobel Prize winners, let's say Chinese or Europeans or others living in the United States who will go on and win a prize. And they will, many of them will cooperate with scientists and collaborators they knew back home. So there's cross-fertilization that really excels in science.
So why is China the exception to the rule that U.S. cancer researchers are actively encouraged to work with colleagues overseas?
So it has not been the exception historically. This is a fairly recent phenomenon. In fact, Chinese and American researchers have collaborated quite extensively over the past few decades, catalyzed obviously by the flow of Chinese talent into the United States. Since the 1980s, postdoctoral students have come over and worked in the most sophisticated labs, not just in cancer research, but engineering and Silicon Valley and aerospace, you name it. They've really sort of provided badly needed science and engineering talent across the spectrum of U.S. industry and research. So they've been here, and they continue to be here, and there continue to be a lot of collaborations. What is much more recent and become an acute concern, and I will quickly interject, this is not just the Trump administration hobby horse. This goes back into the Obama administration. There's been a growing and quite keen concern on Chinese industrial espionage, on the efforts by China to get in any way they can, and if you believe, let's say, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, by hook or by crook or by espionage, our intellectual property in the United States and bring it back to China to seed their own inventions and industries.
Well, let's hear from FBI Director Wray.
No country poses a broader, more severe intelligence collection threat than China. China has pioneered a societal approach to stealing innovation in any way it can from a wide array of businesses, universities, and organizations. They're doing it through Chinese intelligence services, through state-owned enterprises, through ostensibly private companies, through graduate students and researchers, through a variety of actors, all working on behalf of China.
That sounds really terrifying, Peter. Is FBI Director Wray exaggerating the threat?
It's hard to say, right? Because we don't have the insight, the surveillance mechanisms, the undercover capacity that the federal investigative agencies have, obviously led by the FBI, but obviously the National Security Administration, the NSA, has eavesdropping capabilities. So they know a lot of things we don't. And when you ask for details about the background of statements like the ones Director Wray was making on your air now, they don't provide them. What they do provide, and the glimpses that we see, are prosecutions when people get arrested. And there have been some notable arrests, and they provide great windows. There was the arrest of a Chinese operative named Yanjun Xu, last name spelled X-U, just last year. This was someone who was not even operating in the United States. He was operating from China, and he was using LinkedIn to recruit scientists at places like GE Aviation, where he successfully lured a Chinese-American researcher to China to give a presentation on composite plastics for the aerospace industry. And this individual happened to bring over some confidential documents. I don't believe those were shared. I should say I haven't read, or it's not in the documents, that the confidential documents were actually shared with China, but this individual had them when he went to China. He returned to the United States, and the FBI worked with this individual whose name I do not know and has never been prosecuted. But this GE Aviation employee helped the FBI lure this Yanjun Xu from China to Belgium, where he was arrested and extradited to the United States. And he awaits trial in Ohio. So there are these windows, these glimpses of what Director Wray is talking about. All of that said, and granted that China poses a real threat of economic and industrial espionage to the United States, it should also be noted that some of the language he uses is a bit inflammatory and is quite scary, for example, in the Chinese community, where people see it as an overreaction and it's a bad apple situation when you speak with them. They say, well, of course there are going to be spies and people who betray the United States in any large community. But the vast majority of people working here and living here, and many of whom are citizens here, are very loyal and could not appreciate and are not more grateful than any of the rest of us for the opportunities in the United States. So when Director Wray uses terms like whole of society threat, which is his favorite one, that's quite scary to the Chinese community in the United States.
You center your story around an epidemiologist who spent 27 years working at MD Anderson Cancer Center here in Texas. What kind of work did she do?
So her name is Shifang Wu, and she, as you said, is an epidemiologist, a cancer epidemiologist specifically, as all the researchers at MD Anderson specialize in cancer. She came over after doing her master's in China and settled at the University of Texas School of Public Health in Houston, and got her PhD and was hired by MD Anderson right there and then as a PhD student and worked there, as you mentioned, for 27 years. Her specialty are these cohorts. Cohorts are essentially study groups, large databases of patients about whom you have lots and lots of data. So these are people who've come in with lesions or tumors or moles or you name it, some type of cancer, and they've been able to assemble as much data on the individual as possible, such as their the DNA types in their blood and so forth, blood work, the tumor types, and then more importantly, their treatment and the outcome of their treatment, what drugs seem to work or not work. And they'll also get survey information from them about lifestyle habits, so they'll know what their eating habits and sleeping habits are. And they'll have these cohorts, and she amassed several of them on hundreds of thousands of patients, both in Asia, where she had access to databases, and in the United States, specifically Texas. So she had run a very large database on Mexican Americans and other subgroups in the United States, and these databases, these cohorts, are a gold mine for epidemiologists to find out linkages, associations. This type of cell type is amenable to this kind of treatment. This person is eating too much barbecue. Literally, she was one of the researchers who found that charred barbecue is a risk of cancer. And these kinds of issues are very, very useful in science and epidemiology.
So useful in science and epidemiology, it doesn't seem like that sort of work would, even if it were shared, would pose a threat to the interests of U.S. companies looking to, like, develop profitable cancer treatments. Can you patent a discovery about what causes cancer?
So you've put your finger on something that really distresses Shifang Wu, Dr. Wu's many, many friends and admirers and colleagues, both at MD Anderson and in Houston and around the country who she worked with, and frankly around the world, a very accomplished woman. And that is the question of how can you do something in preventive medicine, which essentially is what epidemiology is, where you're telling people what foods to avoid, what lifestyles to lead, when to see a doctor in terms of what type of mole might actually cause cancer, all the epidemiological data that that yields these important insights into disease, how could that be patented or become intellectual property that would be proprietary and valuable that the U.S. would need to hold and make sure other countries, in this case China, didn't get to compete with us? Everyone understands in the defense and security realms, you don't want foreign adversaries, perhaps sometimes even foreign allies, getting your best stuff for weapons and other things that they could use against you in times of war. But it's harder to understand how a cancer epidemiologist could have information like that. But indeed, things have shifted so much so in terms of the rivalry with China that the National Institutes of Health actually takes a very wide view of what essentially is proprietary information now. And I interviewed a gentleman named Lawrence Tabak, who's essentially the number two person at NIH. And of course, NIH is a very influential funder. They give billions and billions of dollars. They're the largest public funder of biomedical research. And so everybody pretty much needs to align themselves with what their view is at any given moment in the research field. And Tabak told me that even something that is in the fundamental research space that's absolutely not classified has an intrinsic value. And I'm quoting him here. He said that this pre-patented material is the antecedent, or I would say the seed, of creating intellectual property. Hmm. In essence, what you're doing, if other people get their hands on that, or in this case China, is stealing other people's ideas. So they're very restrictive now on all kinds of pre-IP information.
My guest is Peter Waldman, a reporter for Bloomberg News, whose recent article was titled, "The U.S. is Purging Chinese Cancer Researchers from Top Institutions." We'll be right back. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with Bloomberg News reporter Peter Waldman about his recent article, The U.S. is Purging Chinese Cancer Researchers from Top Institutions. All right, Peter, I want to talk about a different collaborative relationship these days, the FBI and the National Institutes of Health. They are both federal agencies, but they would seem to be operating in very different spheres most of the time. But now, tell us how the NIH and the FBI are working together.
Sure. That relationship is really the result of this heightened fear of Chinese espionage, and specifically economic and industrial espionage. I think the best way to wrap one's mind around it is to know what happened at MD Anderson. That's the case I wrote about. And what happened there is that the FBI got wind of concerns, and we don't know what they were, but we've seen letters that went back and forth between the FBI, the Department of Justice, and MD Anderson about possible theft of intellectual property a Chinese researcher, but to China anyway. We know that this was possible theft that was flowing to China, and we see the first signs of that in 2017. The FBI sends MD Anderson a letter saying, we want information on a number of your researchers, and we want access to certain emails and other things. And ultimately, the Department of Justice subpoenas MD Anderson for that information in the summer of 2017. And of course, they complied. And from that, we know that there was a national, and in the paperwork, it's referred to as a national security investigation. So the FBI was conducting a national security investigation in 2017 at a time where many of your Texas listeners will know MD Anderson was in some flux. They were changing presidents, and there were temporary people involved in a presidential search and whatnot. And all that was going on. It also had a large financial hit in recent months and past year or so. So administratively, things were somewhat in the air at MD Anderson in Houston. The FBI follows up in the fall of 2017 and says it wants some more information, but there's no subpoena that follows that. There was no demand, no requirement at that point that MD Anderson provide anything. But what we see is in December of 2017, the brand new president of MD Anderson, Peter Pisters, signed a voluntary agreement with the FBI providing information on computer accounts, essentially providing access to computer accounts of a number of MD Anderson researchers. We learned from a different document that was 23. So they voluntarily provided access to 23 computer accounts of researchers at MD Anderson. Knowing that it was China involved and seeing ultimately later Shifeng Wu and five other people being investigated, as I mentioned earlier about Dr. Wu, I asked the question of MD Anderson, were all 23 people whose computer accounts you provided to the FBI ethnic Chinese people? And that's obviously a very important question, because all of these issues swirl around the question of racial profiling, and at what point does a legitimate search for a mole, a spy, whatever, someone being disloyal to an institution who might be providing secret intellectual property or confidential intellectual property to another country, at what point does a search for that become a racially stereotyped, racially profiled search that would raise discriminatory issues and perhaps constitutional issues? It might be illegal. MD Anderson would not answer that question. I asked it on a number of occasions. They say they cannot talk about the FBI interaction at all, even though this was an entirely voluntary provision of these 23 computer accounts We don't know, obviously, who those people are, and we certainly don't know if they are all Chinese or ethnic Chinese people. What we do know is what happened after that. And what ensued is FBI interviewing a number of MD Anderson researchers during the winter and spring of 2018. I spoke to some of those people. The FBI was essentially asking people, do you know people with professional links in China? What's the nature of those ties? They were specifically interested in people who were being recruited by China, not to spy, but to possibly teach or do collaborative research. The background of all of this and what has really made the FBI very concerned, and other certainly members of Congress, this gets a lot of discussion, is an active recruiting effort by China to lure home its outstanding scholars, so many of whom are working and thriving and building important research institutions in the United States and are the, you know, very, very core of scientific endeavor in the United States. Well, China, which is becoming obviously a fast-growing and very successful economy with lots of money to spend on research of its own, wants these people back, and they're making an effort to do that. They're offering them plum jobs with research labs, saying, well, stop using U.S. funding. We will fund you to do this cancer research or whatever it is back here in China. Well, so the FBI, when they started hunting down MD Anderson researchers in the spring of 2018, they were looking for people who were being recruited. And the recruitment program is called Thousand Talents, the Thousand Talents Plan. So in any case, to make a long story short, they ended up being that the FBI provided all of the relevant information that it had to the National Institutes of Health in the summer of 2018. And in the fall of 2018, Francis Collins, who is the director of the National Institutes of Health, and some of his people sent letters to a number of institutions, and five such letters went to MD Anderson asking about specific people who had professional links in China, including Shifang Wu. And those five people were then investigated by MD Anderson, and four of them have left, one of them went back. And it's those people that so many are concerned about within the MD Anderson community, because they are cancer researchers who were doing collaborations in China that were highly encouraged over many years and supported and paid for. And MD Anderson's heart was really in that collaborative research just until recently.
Did you have any indication of whether those collaborations continue to be encouraged when the scientist on the U.S. end is not ethnically Chinese?
Well, there are a number of scientists who do research in China. What I hear from them, who are not ethnic Chinese, what I hear from them is that life has just gotten much more difficult. Mm-hmm. There's much more paperwork. There's much more compliance activity. None of them, all five of the people investigated and the four people who left were ethnic Chinese. So we have no reason to believe that there were any non-ethnic Chinese investigated for their activity in China by MD Anderson. That's not saying that there weren't, but we have never seen evidence that there were.
You also found that Chinese-American defendants, people who actually come in for charges by the FBI, are wrongly accused or charged without being convicted at twice the rate of non-Chinese-American scientists. Is that accurate?
Well, that comes from a Cardozo Law Review paper that was published in December 2018. It was written by a Houston lawyer named Andrew Kim, who's also a visiting professor of law. And Andrew Kim concluded by doing a study of all the economic espionage cases going all the way back to 1997. And he found something quite interesting. He found that between 1997 and 2009, about 17% of the economic espionage prosecutions in the United States were of defendants who had Chinese names. We don't know anything. We don't know where they were from. They could be Taiwanese. They could be Singaporean. They could be named Lee, L-E-E, right, and not be Chinese at all. But these were people of with Chinese names, and that was through 2009. Between 2009 and 2015, the rate or the percentage of all economic espionage cases brought by the federal government tripled against Chinese Americans. Against Chinese names. So between 2009 and 2015, 52%, so more than half of all economic espionage cases were against people with Chinese names. So when you have such a dramatic increase of one group of defendants, the chances are the evidence may not be as strong, right? Because you're really targeting one group. You hope that the evidence is very strong and that they're going to get a lot of convictions. But I think predictably, if you're going to ratchet up scrutiny and prosecutions of one group, perhaps you'll have fewer convictions. And indeed, that's what happened. So what you see here is that, just what you said, roughly one out of five or 20% of these prosecutions of Chinese-named defendants end in no serious conviction at all. So four out of five do, one out of five do not. The rate of conviction, serious conviction against people with non-Chinese names is much higher. It's 90%. So they're convicting 90% of non-Chinese names and only 80% of Chinese names. So that suggests, and this this law professor, Andrew Kim, says that he believes there has been a growing bias in the law enforcement community and an assumption that if you are Chinese and you're involved in science and engineering, your loyalty is to Beijing and not to Washington, and that they're gonna find charges and ways of making your life tough. He calls it, he coined the term researching while Asian, and that's based on this business about driving while African American, right, that you might be familiar with.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. We have Mark on the line in Bartonville, Texas. Hi, Mark.
Oh, yes, thank you very much. It's fascinating. Sadly, my wife and I are, my wife is a patient at MD Anderson. We're in a very exclusive drug trial program. All of the researchers, it's a rare and fatal form of cancer, all of the researchers are of Chinese ancestry, Chinese names. There is a palpable sense of stress among the staff. The waiting room would be a full, typically, of 150 people, all literally fighting for their lives. And I would venture to say that maybe a tiny percentage of those people have any understanding of what's happening at MD Anderson, the history within the administration, and the research issues you're discussing. I happen to. But my question is more one of practical utilization of this knowledge. How, for example, would a patient that wants some assurance, I would not ask our primary research doctor about this, although I'm inclined to want to understand his perspective and understand how he's experiencing it. But there are, you know, extremely real patient ramifications, and this information is profoundly disturbing and hard to apply in a kind of patient perspective. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Mark, thank you for calling, and very best wishes to your wife. I'm sorry for what she's struggling with right now. Peter, do you have any thoughts for Mark?
Well, the first thought that comes to my mind is, Mark, you're in the right place. I mean, let's not forget, MD Anderson is just a preeminent cancer center, and it's certainly a place I would go with my loved ones were someone to have cancer. As to how this can affect specific researchers, I think you're probably right that the Chinese researchers at MD Anderson, in fact, I know you're right from speaking to many of them, have a great deal of concern about what happened. Mainly, they feel that the goalposts were changed on them, that that all this encouragement to collaborate and funding and so forth, in some cases back home, so to speak, or back with colleagues and people they went to school with, and is now taboo or literally illegal, or somewhat, someone used the word criminalized. I think that's too strong a word, but in any case, it's discouraged now. So that's a stressor on their lives. But if I know the quality of people that MD Anderson hires and attracts, those scientists and doctors you're working with are not going to let that interfere with their work.
Dr. Wu is a naturalized U.S. citizen. Did any of her colleagues raise concerns that she might somehow be not loyal to MD Anderson or to the United States?
Not just her colleagues who didn't raise that concern, but in reality, when you read the report, as I did, as we got through the Texas Public Records Act, that MD Anderson produced about her case and her ties to China, there is not a specific allegation in there, not just that of her sharing information or being disloyal about providing some kind of secret, although, as you said before, what could that possibly be in epidemiology, right? These are not drug compounds that some pharmaceutical company is going to make billions from. This is data and information that informs that way down the line. But they not only didn't make an allegation about that, they did not have a specific case where they showed or could prove or have evidence of her receiving money. So it's not as though she was being kind of induced or bribed to provide anything.
My guest is Peter Waldman. He's a reporter for Bloomberg News and recently published a piece with the headline, "The U.S. is purging Chinese cancer researchers from top institutions." Chris Boyd speaking this hour with Bloomberg News reporter Peter Waldman about his recent article, "The U.S. is purging Chinese cancer researchers from top institutions." So, Peter, in this country, we profess to believe that one is innocent until proven guilty. But you only have to sit through jury selection once or twice to know that there are many Americans who have the sense that if someone has been accused of something, then perhaps they've done something wrong, even if it can't be proven. So what is the career fallout for someone who's been investigated by the FBI for potentially inappropriate collaboration with Chinese institutions? Like, are funders scared off? Do people end up getting demoted or not promoted? What have you learned about that?
So it's disastrous. And it's not just disastrous for them, it's disastrous for their whole lab. Because let's not forget, a senior researcher at a place like MD Anderson or at Emory University, which is another place that's had this issue come up, has a dozen, sometimes as many as two dozen people in their lab, postdocs, perhaps from around the world, other, you know, obviously from around the United States, and their funding suddenly gets, you know, redistributed anyway, and then they have to find a new mentor or a new thesis advisor, and their research is completely scrambled. So the whole enterprise is disrupted. With one of the fallouts, it's very interesting. I mean, let's face it, the people, including Shifang Wu, who are identified in this problem, are clearly have relationships in China. These are people, you know, this doesn't come out of the blue. I don't think these are false accusations to the extent that they're focusing on people who go back and forth in China and have, you know, research projects, maybe sometimes parallel labs, although Shifang Wu is an epidemiologist, so she didn't have a lab. But sometimes people have parallel operations over there. And the one place that they turn to when this comes up, and this has happened in several cases, is China. So they go back. And we lose, in several cases, just dynamic, important, top-of-field talent.
So, yeah, that's the extraordinary irony of this story with regard to Zhifeng Wu, who had been this huge asset to MD Anderson. She ultimately quit after being placed on administrative leave and moved to Shanghai.
She did, and she got a job at an important school of public health. She's now the dean at that school of public health, so she is continuing. On a personal note for her, her children and husband continue to live and study and work in the United States. Her husband is a notable, I believe, pathologist in the Houston area, and that's a big loss for their family. They're separated now. But she could land on her feet because she's so well known. The other thing is about these individuals, they were also highly recruited, right? So I mentioned when the FBI fanned out to interview all these MD Anderson researchers of Chinese extraction, they were targeting the people they knew were recruited. The recruitment wasn't a secret, which is really interesting. So it's not just the FBI. Other law enforcement agencies and federal funding groups like the National Science Foundation and NASA and others, the ones they're really watching out for are people who've been named and listed on websites in China very proudly trumpeting the fact that they're lecturing this summer at some university in Chengdu, or they're giving a seminar for students in Beijing. These are people who these are members of the MD Anderson faculty or Emory University or Harvard or Stanford, you name it. This is something that was trumpeted widely. This was a kind of success for the Communist Party leadership that they could bring these people back from America just to appear a few times in the United States or to help with some student issues or research issues. Let alone move back. So this was very easy. I mean, it's not like they didn't need the NSA to listen to a bunch of phone calls to figure out who these people were. These people were all over the internet as having these relationships in China. So that's where they went back. They go back when they come under stress. I'm actually doing a follow-up story on a number of these people who've gone back to China throwing up their arms at what they consider to be the sort of badgering and in some cases wrongful indictment by the federal government for what they've done. And when I say they consider, I mean it was wrongful in the sense that it got dropped. It was one of these many dismissed cases in one case. There's a well-known case that was written up a while ago of the foremost NOAA, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, the federal agency that looks into meteorology and weather and climate and all those things, the foremost expert at the NOAA on the effect of climate change and hurricanes, an issue important in Texas, right? And this person was living in Miami, was working for NOAA in Miami, and had been recruited back to do a little bit of lecturing, and over the course of 3 years, I think it was 2010 to 2013, had taken $2,000, a minuscule amount over 3 years for somebody like that, to do some teaching and lecturing in China, and was arrested at some point returning to the United States and indicted on a federal felony charge of supplementing his federal income, which lo and behold is a felony. And one thing led to another. I think there were 8 charges involved in that, and he was looking at real prison time. And he ultimately took a government deal and pleaded to 1 charge. It went in of supplementing his government salary. I mean, he took the $2,000. What could he say? Over 3 years, while winning awards. This was a period when he was named the top researcher 1 year and the top scientist another year in NOAA, in the federal branch that studies this stuff. So while doing that, he was teaching a little in China. He took this single charge, pleaded guilty. It went in front of the judge in the federal court in Miami. And she literally said to him, "I'm only sorry to see you here. This should never have happened. Hmm. The importance of your work is such that, you know, we should have found a way not to prosecute you for this. I have to accept your plea. You did this. You're pleading guilty to it. I will sentence you to time served, which was 4 days when he was arrested. And good luck, sir, to your career. And the judge added, back in China, because he has left NOAA and is doing his work in China.
Presumably, the Chinese government's desire to steal intellectual property for its own gain doesn't know borders, right? So I'm curious about whether the EU and Australia and Latin America, other parts of the world, have responded the same way to concerns about Chinese intellectual property theft.
Nowhere near as aggressively as the United States that I'm aware of. The Trump administration is trying to mobilize and rally Western countries, countries everywhere, against this Chinese telecommunications company called Huawei. It's a funny spelling. It's spelled with an H at the beginning, but it's pronounced Huawei. And that's the company whose CFO was arrested in Vancouver and is still awaiting possible extradition to the United States. Very, very high-level executive, an important person in a very important company. The U.S. regards it as literally one big pipe of espionage communications that if we and other countries adopt their telecommunications standards specifically for so-called 5G, the next generation of wireless technology, that all that information will flow directly to the Chinese government. And it's a valid and legitimate concern, of course. And the Trump administration has been very active on that. And it's had mixed success. There are some countries that are being more cognizant and dealing with us more on that issue. Several are quite leery of this as being a kind of Trumpian xenophobic response. This is a little bit of a, crying wolf story in the sense that when a government like ours is viewed as being somewhat xenophobic and concerned, perhaps irrationally in some people's eyes, about other countries and other races and nationalistic, then when you go to them and say, well, you need to join our crusade against China on Huawei, they're kind of looking at you like, well, all right, you're keeping, little Central American children in prisons on the border. I mean, there's a good deal of leeriness, whether rightful or not. I mean, this is a very serious technological issue, but it's tough. It's tough when you have to convince people.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Just to be clear, when a scientist at a U.S. cancer institution builds a relationship with a Chinese cancer lab or researchers there, it is a two-way pipeline, right? I mean, they're giving and receiving information.
That's true. And the Shifang Wu case is an excellent example. One of the main attributes of her work was all of the data from Chinese cancer patients that was available to our scholars to study in these cohorts. So she was very successful in going back and forth and putting all of this stuff together. Not just that, there are many rare diseases. I mean, Mark called earlier, whose spouse is suffering from a rare disease. Many rare cancers are more common in other places, and there's no more populous and now somewhat prosperous place than China, where data can be studied and amassed. So actually, there is another researcher who was investigated and has left MD Anderson, who was studying a very rare blood disorder and was using Chinese data because there were many more people there who suffered from that disorder, and they were collecting it, and he was teaching them how to collect it. And MD Anderson, in essentially pushing this person out, said, well, you are providing all this know-how, all this information to these Chinese laboratories to do this work. You're giving them information that should be ours and kept here. And their response was, but no, they're helping us because we're able to study this disease that's far more prevalent there, and we have sufferers in this country, and without them, we couldn't figure things out. So it's a very graphic example in that case. I can't use that person's name, unfortunately, but this is another grievous loss for MD Anderson.
In Anderson's defense, if the NIH is suspicious of ethnic Chinese scientists, an institution like Anderson can't afford to go without NIH funding, can it?
Absolutely not, and I do understand that part of this. I think MD Anderson received something like $148 million of NIH funding in 2018, so it's a significant amount of money for them. This gets to really an elemental question, and I think it's an important one for your Texas audience. Why MD Anderson? Why did they seem to be so much more enthusiastic and cooperative with the government on this issue than other institutions? I mean, we've seen Stanford, Yale, a whole series of other schools produce these letters of glowing support for their Chinese faculty and for the collaborations, and essentially saying, you know, we're a sanctuary university. Mm. They don't say it. They don't use that word. But that's really what they're saying is we will protect these people. There is no way we are going to provide computer accounts on our researchers, you know, without a subpoena, certainly, or a warrant or whatever is necessary. We have a case in University of Wisconsin in Madison where the FBI came calling for an engineer, for information about an engineer who was doing auto safety testing in China, and they wanted to know more about him and so forth. And Madison said, take a hike. We, you know, if you're going to come after our people, we at least bring us a warrant. I mean, give us a subpoena. Give us probable cause that he's done something wrong. And to this day, that they haven't come back that I'm aware of. So this bottom line question, why MD Anderson? The $148 million is an important part of it. I don't think I know the rest of it. I can tell you that I'm told MD Anderson has long and close ties to the FBI Houston office. They've worked together on things. Who knows exactly? It was also a year of flux. 2017 was a tough year at MD Anderson.
Peter Waldman is a reporter for Bloomberg News. His recent article is titled, The U.S. is Purging Chinese Cancer Researchers from Top Institutions. Peter, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Use your favorite podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast and check out upcoming episodes at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.